the image of God and modernity. The idea of the image of God is a big idea, and it invites a large-scale ramble through the history of ideas. So I hope to lead this ramble for you through some big ideas that are important for at least getting in touch with. And I hope to do it without too much sidetracking, but there's a lot here. So I've provided a chart with the authors and the big ideas that I have in mind, and hopefully we'll sort of braid them together as we go along. In the end, I want to argue that being an intellect in the flesh, and thus made to the image of God, generates for us certain freedoms against some of the burdens that modern thinkers have unnecessarily laid upon us and upon our way of thinking. So I'm going to breeze through some big personalities and try to give an idea of how this primarily biblical idea cashes out for philosophy. As far as the moderns go, I've selected two of my favorite arch-villains of modernity. I'm not going to attempt to say what modernity is or give any kind of complete story. Often that would include something about Kant and Descartes. I assume they'll come up later. But instead I've picked Nietzsche and Hobbes to represent the modern legacy with regard to the image of God. But let's begin with the Bible itself. We would be naive to think that the Bible doesn't have philosophy. In fact, it has many philosophies. The image of God ties together many different biblical thinkers, many sacred authors, beginning with the author of Genesis. So we begin simple with Genesis. A lot can be said about the narrative of Genesis 1 and 2, but let's keep it simple. In Genesis, God says, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness." In this narrative, it's important to see that the image of God is connected with dominion, mastery. It's not limited to Adam, but it's explicitly extended to both man and woman, both Adam and Eve. And many have noticed that in this creation narrative, the first creation narrative in the Bible, we don't hear anything about angels. The angels are not explicitly created on one of the days. So this is a very earthy story. The image of God is something in the flesh. Let's move on to the Book of Wisdom. I love the Book of Wisdom. I'm very angry when people try to take it out of the Bible. And the removal of the Book of Wisdom by Protestant reformers has been disastrous for Western thought because it provides a kind of segue into the New Testament that's indispensable. Indispensable both for understanding the context of Jesus and Paul, and for understanding the thoughts of Paul especially. So, in chapter 7, speaking in the person of Solomon, the author of Wisdom, begins a praise of the spirit of wisdom. Wisdom as a spirit. Wisdom gives knowledge not only of material reality, like roots and animals, many material things are listed, but also of the power of spirits and the thoughts of men. There's an encomium of wisdom, which is a she. The she is the reflection of the eternal light, the mirror of God, and the image of his goodness. There's image. So we have creation, and we have image. Wisdom is with God in the beginning, and in Wisdom 7 we hear that wisdom takes precedence over light. So wisdom comes even before the first day, light and dark. We can move now to St. Paul. St. Paul wrote not long after the Book of Wisdom was written. And if you know some of the parallels, they're striking. For example, with the letter to the Romans. These two creation accounts that we've gotten from Genesis and Wisdom are somewhat different, and Paul and others work to harmonize them. So we notice, for instance, that there are spiritual beings mentioned in Wisdom, not in Genesis. Paul introduces the idea that Jesus is the image of God. We see that in both Colossians and 2 Corinthians. So Jesus is the image of the invisible God. And as Paul says in Colossians 1, in him everything was created. So in the image of God, everything was created. We must hear Wisdom 7. He extends this creation explicitly to the angelic creation. And he gives us some very precious names, the names of angelic ranks, like dominions, principalities, authorities. These are names that Pseudo Dionysius and Gregory the Great worked very hard to harmonize and put in order as authentic parts of the revealed creation. Then in 2 Corinthians, Paul also presents an important new idea, that there's a progress in being to the image of God. So it is not a static, but a dynamic quality of the human soul. We are being changed from glory to glory after the image of Christ, whose face, the face of Jesus, reflects God's light, and whom we reflect. We look in his face and we reflect that light, which is the light on the face of God. Again, wisdom was the reflection of the eternal light, the mirror of God, the image of his goodness. So we hear that there's a conversation going on within the Bible itself. Wisdom and Paul also reflect something outside of the Bible. They reflect a Greek philosophical thought that preceded them by several centuries. So they both reflect Greek philosophies or philosophers. And so Plato and Aristotle will turn out to be indispensable for our understanding the idea of the image of God, which is a biblical concept. We're both going to look to the Bible and look toward the fathers and look towards the medievals and look toward modernity so that we can get some idea of the image of God. And just to give the basic Christian idea, influenced indeed by this Greek teaching about the rationality of the human being, we have to just basically understand that all Christians take the image of God to mean, what is it that makes human beings unique among all the created beings? They have reason. They have the power of reason. So it's a sort of indisputed basis that reason sets man apart from rocks, plants, which are better than rocks, and animals, which are better than plants, and puts the rational being at the top. Now, it takes some doing to figure out what this means. Okay, so let's go into the Greek thinkers that we've got here. Again, this is going to be a trot. I'm not attempting to do justice to Plato. We'll begin with Plato, but this is not my interpretation of Plato. This is Platonism, common Platonism, which is necessary for a thoughtful understanding of the biblical writers. These writers are instrumentalizing the Platonic tradition. They're taking the tradition of Plato and his followers and using it to their own ends. And they're using it to understand the Imago Dei from Genesis. So, for Plato, big idea. Our souls pre-exist our bodies. In some way or another, we existed before we came into the world. If you've read some of the myths of Plato's dialogues, you'll know of an idea of reincarnation, so that souls would migrate from body to body, and the change would be in some way a result of the life lived in one body. But in addition to being in bodies, they have eternal aspects. They migrate through these different lives, forgetting what they knew before, and then remembering the ideas that have always resided in them. So this begins with mathematical objects. One of the most famous moments where Plato describes Socrates' teaching is where he takes an uneducated boy and leads him through a mathematical proof to show that he had the knowledge in him. So he demonstrates that the soul is immortal by showing that this uneducated boy had in him an immortal thing, an eternal thing, which was math. And math is very important. And it's drawn out in conversation, dialectic, and demonstration. But this also includes the knowledge of higher things than the mathematical objects. It includes the knowledge of forms, eternal objects which are causes of the bodily things that we perceive. So for Plato, there are, in some way or another, immortal forms which cause the things which imitate them in the material world. Plato, who followed Pythagoras in this, doesn't claim to be wise. So he says that instead of being wise, he's a lover of wisdom. So instead of being Sophos, or a wise man, he's a philosophos, a lover of wisdom. And Nietzsche was really bothered by this. Nietzsche thought that this was a false modesty, that we should claim to be wise if we're wise, and that to be modest about that is disastrous for life, for confidence, greatness, power. We can agree with Nietzsche in a certain sense that there is a humility here. Plato is noting that truth is discovered through memory, so it's not self-generated. We don't create the truths, but we find them. We find them in ourselves, and so we have a debt to some prehistory. It's a debt to a pre-existing wisdom, you could say. So we'll return to this when we talk about Nietzsche. Plato's student, Aristotle, differed with him about how we know and also about how we're disposed towards the things that we know. So Aristotle saw the rational soul as a blank slate. He didn't think that there were ideas waiting to be uncovered or drawn out. Instead, he said that the impressions of forms needed to somehow be impressed on the senses, and that that was how we come to know, through the senses. He did agree that formal or immaterial knowledge, the knowledge through forms, is attainable through, again, dialectic and demonstration. So he believed in wisdom and in science, like Plato did. But how did he bridge this gap between needing to learn through the senses and recollecting knowledge? To bridge the gap, he articulated an idea of abstraction. To abstract means to draw out from. So the intellect abstracts forms from the things that it senses. It takes them for itself. But the way that it does this is immaterial, because forms are themselves immaterial. The intellect is capable of conforming itself to immaterial forms, which are given from without. He says, kind of mystically, that man, by his rational soul, becomes the thing that he knows. He becomes it in an immaterial mode. He remains material the same. Maybe when he's coming to know something, he feels some joy, he feels some exhaustion. But immaterially, his soul conforms itself to the form of the thing known. So there is a certain passivity here. One has to be passive towards the realities which come from outside. But there's also a kind of spiritual mastery of reality. So there's an ability which is being shown, an ability to become all things. And this is the basis for many of the glories of human life, that we're able to know things in such a way that we can analyze them and we can rearrange them. So it shows a certain immaterial, spiritual, almost angelic mastery of the material world. If we move to the realm of the good life, of virtue, we can see that there's a connection to an idea that is pretty well known in Aristotle, that of magnanimity. So magnanimity means having a great soul, being great-souled. So Aristotle says, there is a man who knows how great he is, and that itself is a virtue. So the moral virtues make someone good, great even, but then to know with regard to other people how great you are gives you a certain gravity. He says he speaks with a slow voice, he walks deliberately, he's ironic to people who are lower than him. Aristotle sees this as a kind of crowning virtue. And we can note here that there's a kind of self-reliance here. So the great-souled man doesn't really need things from others. He has a kind of perfect virtue. And this is a way that the Stoics would follow Aristotle, that perfect self-control, spiritual freedom, is a characteristic of perfect virtue. So I've already begun to speak about these things in a way that relies on Professor John O'Callaghan's connection made between Nietzsche and other thinkers. So Professor O'Callaghan, who couldn't be here, has drawn out this connection between Platonic remembering and Aristotelian cognition on the one hand, and on the other hand, the humility, the modesty that goes along with recollection, memory, and the kind of proud magnanimity of virtue in Aristotle, virtuous self-containment, self-reliance. For Aristotle, the great-souled or magnanimous man remembers the gifts that he's given to others. He thinks about the great things that he's done. He remembers them with pleasure. But he is pained sometimes when he realizes that he does owe a debt to others. He realizes that he is a man and that he has not made everything that he is. This is an unavoidable consequence of his fleshly life. So, somewhat anachronistically, we're going to move now to two pairings, Nietzsche and Augustine and Hobbes and Aquinas. The first pairing is from Professor O'Callaghan, and the second one's mine. But so we're not going to seek a chronological trot through the big thinkers, but there's going to be sort of two duets going on, one between Nietzsche and Augustine, and the other between Hobbes and Aquinas. So for Nietzsche, the great man, who he calls noble, in the same tradition as Plato and Aristotle, noble as in beautiful or distinguished. For the great man, there is a certain freedom or sovereignty, which Nietzsche says is expressed in his being like only to himself. O'Callaghan points out that there's a German wordplay in this phrase. The nobleman is like himself. He copies only himself. That is to say, he is not an image of another. He is the exemplar. He is the image maker. Others are images of him. In order to arrive at this state, though, he needs to overcome this problem that the Aristotelian great-souled man had. He needs to forget what he owes to other people. So active forgetting is an important principle for the great man in Nietzsche. A general point about Nietzsche is that the principle of a thriving, powerful life kind of takes control of other human efforts like philosophy or history. And for this, you can look not only at The Will to Power and The Genealogy of Morals, which are important works, but also a smaller work, which is very telling, called The Usefulness and Disadvantage of History for Life. So we can even raise the question of history. Is history important? If it's going to make us weak, should we even pursue it? So that shows you something about how life and its thriving and its power can subordinate things that we take for granted as important. If history is not useful, then maybe we should forget it, is what Nietzsche is saying here and in that work more at length. O'Callaghan compares the active forgetting of Nietzsche's noble man with Descartes. Descartes had this goal to establish thought all on the basis of self-thought. He sort of thinks himself, and by means of thinking himself, he's able to think everything else. And it's a kind of mathematical demonstration that he proceeds from himself towards kinds of other knowledge. So we have a kind of perverse Plato. We have a twisted Platonism in Descartes. I find the sources of truth, but I find them simply in myself, not from somewhere before me. This doesn't mean that I have recollected them. It means that I am the source without a source. Source without a source is an early Christian term for God. So to be the source of yourself. So we can arrive now anachronistically at St. Augustine. Augustine was very much concerned with the interpretation of Genesis, so he commented on Genesis several times in different works. But we're going to find his most important reflection on the Imago Dei in his work De Trinitate, on the Trinity. In De Trinitate, Augustine uses reflection on the human soul to understand the Trinity. This doesn't mean that he finds the Trinity in the human soul. In books 1 through 7 of De Trinitate, he uses first the scriptures to arrive at a knowledge of God. He also uses Plato and Aristotle, categories and dialectic, but he's basing everything that he says on sacred scripture. But once he's done that, once he's sort of discovered the Trinity, he can turn to the human soul as a means to learn more about the Trinity, because he realizes he doesn't understand the Trinity. After his Christian conversion, he maintains a great respect for the Platonists. He always talks about how he read the books of the Platonists. We don't necessarily know exactly what he read, but it was a school of thought that exerted a force on him and others. But he learned to take Scripture as a kind of overriding authority with respect to the Platonists. That Scripture could override something if it was incorrect in the Academy and Plato's followers. So he comes to hold, even if with some difficulty, that our souls do not pre-exist our bodies. Some people differ about exactly what he thinks about this, because he's struggling with it. He knows what Plato taught, that we have eternal things in us. Where do they come from? Besides that difficulty, though, Augustine maintains that memory is the privileged route to God. And we see this most vividly, not so much in the De Trinitate as in his Confessions. So if you've read his Confessions, you know that Augustine is getting to God through a recollection of his own life. It's a sort of novel form of literature at the time, that by means of an autobiography, you can come to a knowledge of eternal things. So there's two things we should note about Augustine. In the De Trinitate, we hear sensitivity. Augustine has a great sensitivity to St. Paul's idea of this dynamic nature of the Imago Dei. He understands that our being made to the image of God implies a movement. We're always moving from lesser to greater. So he appreciates and develops this idea of growing from a basic intellectual power through grace to glory. Second thing we can pick up from St. Augustine is that the flesh is a sight of memory, and memory is important for coming to know God. So it would be wrong to say Augustine was so influenced by different philosophical sects that he didn't get the importance of the flesh. The Confessions, and even De Trinitate, show that he's really sensitive to our being time-bound creatures. And for an ancient, being in time means that you are in the flesh. And memory is a quasi-bodily activity. So memory shows that he has a kind of respect for our time-bound and flesh-bound nature, and through it, We can navigate to the eternal. Okay, I'm going to move on, trot along. And so Nietzsche and Augustine made a kind of pair. We see that for Nietzsche, the great man needs to forget in order to come into his own, in order to reach his glory, you could say. Whereas for Augustine, the way to glory is through memory. Now, for a pretty different pair, which I hope will draw out another kind of contrast between an ancient and a modern way of looking at the Imago Dei, Hobbes and Aquinas. So Augustine was known for being skeptical of earthly rule, possibility of a just society on earth. Whatever we may think about that, Thomas Hobbes expressed a much more absolute and violent skepticism about the goodness of rule. Hobbes's Leviathan proposes that our violent regard for one another flows from our nature. We may not be naturally bound to kill one another, but the way that our nature is constituted leaves that as basically the only option for Hobbes. By means of art, or artificial knowledge, man comes to do what God did in creation. So God created, and he created something in his own image. He created man. For Hobbes, man used his intellect, the intellectual virtue of art, to create society, the state, the commonwealth. He says, "For by art is created that great Leviathan, called a commonwealth, or state, in Latin, civitas, which is but an artificial man, and in which sovereignty is an artificial soul." Sovereignty means freedom. So freedom is an artificial soul in the artificial man of the state. And Hobbes makes this creation parallel very clear when he comes to talk about pacts held between men. He says that human pacts resemble that fiat, or that "let us make man," pronounced by God at the creation. So we have the creation of human society by means of art. Hobbes then proceeds in a very interesting order in Leviathan. He begins with man, and he starts by talking about how he comes to know. Then he goes on to talk later about a Christian civilization. That's the third part of four. And then in the fourth part, he talks about what he calls the kingdom of darkness, which is basically Catholic Church. He has some other enemies that he wants to throw into the kingdom of darkness, but it's largely a response to Robert Bellarmine. So his work proceeds in an interesting order because he begins with how man comes to know through sense perception. And then he ends in the kingdom of darkness. So how do we get from chapter 1 of sense in the Leviathan to the kingdom of darkness? The kingdom of darkness is a misinterpretation of nature and of scripture, which yields things like priests and monks and nuns and the veneration of angels and other fantastical beings. For Hobbes, our knowledge is all sensory. Bodies make an impression on us, and we understand them according to sense and imagination. He relates this to the Greek idea of phantasia, so he calls it fancy. And in the very first chapter on sense, Hobbes issues an explicit salvo against the Aristotelians, the universities. Anyone who dares to claim that we abstract forms from objects that we perceive, he says, they're making an insignificant speech. Their speech does not signify. So the scholastic way of saying, or the Aristotelian way of saying, that there are forms or species in things which we then draw out, he's saying this is just made up. I'm going to leap over the middle part of the Leviathan now. That's the part that everyone loves, about how human life is solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. To get to the part about the angels. There's many ways of conceiving what modernity is. I really like one from the Catholic philosopher Remy Brog, who says, one might perhaps characterize modernity, not without a touch of pedagogical exaggeration, as the age without angels. The angels disappear. They're evacuated from the universe. For Hobbes, the angels spoken of in Scripture are not beings per se. He wants to have a respect for Scripture, but he thinks that angels should be understood as messengers, which they are, and not as something more, not as immaterial beings. It's an idle fancy to propose immaterial reality, and in his mind it's unwarranted to add extra things to what Scripture says. To lose the angels is to lose much. One big thing that we seem to lose with angels is hierarchy. So the reflection on the angels helped the early church to understand itself as a journey towards God, a joining in the angelic life, and a heavenly perfection through greater and greater immateriality towards union with the One who is perfectly immaterial. This is what hierarchy means. So it's no surprise that you take the angels away and there's not a lot of useful scriptural help for understanding hierarchy. Hobbes, removing the angels, removing any immateriality to our life, is able to view the Catholic hierarchy then with contempt. He compares priests and monks to the fairies of old wives' tales. This is an extremely well-written and vicious passage of Leviathan. And he talks about the similarities that angels dwell in darkness and monks walk around in darkness in their cloisters and angels don't marry and neither do priests. So it's very specific and it's kind of funny, which is why it's very dangerous. So consider for now, though, how it makes sense that after having removed all immateriality from our way of knowing, much further down the road, the forms of governance in our lives, which are immaterial, whether secular or sacred, will also lack ground. So we can think now not only about the church governance, but the civic governance, which directs people towards goods like knowledge and love. This is something that civil society does. But if there is no responsibility for immaterial life in civic government, which there is not for Hobbes, then you're going to lose that coherence of goods which are transcendent. Okay. Move to St. Thomas Aquinas. St. Thomas, we can notice with some surprise, takes a kind of similar approach in the Prima Pars. So Hobbes talks about sense and then goes on to governance. Thomas does the same thing. His treatment of man falls in the first part of the Summa. So the organization of the Summa goes like this. Begin with what is theology? And then we move on to a lot of questions about what is God. And then St. Thomas turns to what are the things that proceed from God, creatures. He talks about, first, the immaterial creation, angels. Then he goes on to the 6 days and ultimately arrives at man. So this belongs in the context of creation. So you can see here that we're also dealing with a nestled commentary on creation, nestled in the broader schema of the Summa, which is God, man, and Christ. Aquinas follows Aristotle, and he says that our knowledge is through the senses. So he agrees that we don't get our knowledge simply by getting access to immaterial forms. So far, he also is agreeing with Hobbes. But ultimately, Thomas's concern is not with that. His concern is with the immaterial life of the soul, which is able to endure death. And so in this, he enters the Platonic conversation of the immortal soul. And then he has to ask how we can live and know when our souls are separated from our bodies. In this discussion, which is intensely complicated, Thomas affirms many of the aspects of what I've already been talking about: the Genesis narratives, the angelic creation, Christ as the image of God and wisdom, and the Trinity as something that can be learned about through a kind of sacred memory. He puts all of this in an ascending order in the section on man. So sense, knowledge, and governance. So then that way is similar to Hobbes. And in the middle of that order, he places question 93, which is about the end or the terminus of the production of man, insofar as he is said to be made to the image and likeness of God. So end or terminus, meaning what is his goal? Where is he going? Insofar as he is to be made to the image and likeness of God. We can notice that a dispute has arisen in Thomas's time about, is it the image of God or to the image of God? The Latin version of the Genesis verse is ad imaginem Dei, so to the image of God. So what does that mean? Question 93 also is central to the Summa in a certain sense. So question 93 belongs in an interesting spot with regard to other big highlights. I like the prefaces, the prologues to the parts of the Summa, because they tell you a lot in very few words. So we have question 1, what is theology? And then question 2, St. Thomas says, like, okay, let's plan out the whole thing. And there he says he's going to discuss God, the motion of the rational creature toward God or into God, and then Christ as man's way to God. So the promise of the second part, that motion of the rational creature into God, ad de, or in deum, refers to the image of God. How do we know that? Because at the beginning of the second part, the secunda pars, Thomas brings up the image of God. He cites St. John Damascene, and he says, insofar as we're made to the image of God, we have self-will, which will move us towards God as our good. So that refers back to this question 93. So question 93 gets us through the end of the first part into the second part. It's kind of an engine. So if you look at the first quotation under this chart, we can see that St. Thomas has definitely preserved this idea of the dynamic image of God from Paul and Augustine. We see that the image of God is in man in three ways. First, inasmuch as man possesses a natural aptitude for understanding and loving God. So like we've talked about, the image of God is intellect, which makes us able to know and to love. And this aptitude consists in the very nature of the mind, which is common to all men. So everyone has this, no matter how terrible they are. Second, inasmuch as man actually and habitually knows and loves God, though imperfectly. And this image consists in the conformity of grace. So there's the second stage, grace. We begin to imperfectly know and love God, which is a actualization of the imago Dei that is common. Third, inasmuch as man knows and loves God perfectly, and this image consists in the likeness of glory. So glory is where the imperfect state of grace is completed, and the image of God finds its finality, its end. Wherefore, on the words, "The light of thy countenance, O Lord, is signed upon us," the gloss distinguishes a threefold image of creation, of recreation, and of likeness. The first is found in all men, the second only in the just, the third only in the blessed. Notice that scriptural citation, "The light of thy countenance, O Lord, is signed upon us." In a way, that draws together all of the biblical authors we've been talking about. That God has signed himself on us, that it is a light, and that shining on the face of Jesus, we reflect the light of the countenance of God. So there are two ways in which our being in the flesh is a special mode of the Imago Dei, beyond that of the angels. Look at the second quotation. "We may speak of God's image in two ways. First, we may consider in it that in which the image chiefly consists, that is, the intellectual nature." So in this question, he's talking about whether the image of God is more so in angels or in men. So it's already been admitted that the angels and men share this Imago Dei. "Thus, the image of God is more perfect in the angels than in man, because their intellectual nature is more perfect, as is clear from what has been said." Question 58, question 79. "Second, though, we may consider the image of God in man as regards its accidental qualities, so far as to observe in man a certain imitation of God consisting in the fact that man proceeds from man as God from God, and also in the fact that the whole human soul is in the whole body, and again in every part, as God is in regard to the whole world. In these and the like things, the image of God is more perfect in man than it is in the angels. But these do not of themselves belong to the nature of the divine image in man, unless we presuppose the first likeness, which is in the intellectual nature. Otherwise, even brute animals would be to God's image." What St. Thomas seems to be doing here is accepting and protecting the legacy of Augustine and others, and talking about the intellectual nature as something we can reflect directly on. But he's also adding some things about our embodied nature, that man proceeds from man as God from God. Angels don't generate other angels, but human beings do. And he's saying that by generation, we imitate the Son's generation from the Father. And also, the whole human soul is in the whole body, and again, in every part. That would take a little bit of explaining, but this is an Aristotelian principle, that the soul is present throughout the body. And we sort of see this in the Bible, that when the foot is hurt, the eye kind of takes part in that pain. Man's way of being in his own body is like God's way of being in the world. That's also striking because God governs the world and man governs his body. Man, then, by understanding the governance of his own body, comes to understand how God governs the world. The medievals and others, the ancients, would call man a minor world. So within himself he has the whole world. Not only is he like a city, as Plato would say, but he is like the cosmos. So his way of being in his body is like God's presence in the cosmos. And in that, he is unlike the angels and like the image of God. So I would like to connect this with human governance. St. Thomas proposes that even in paradise, before the fall, it would have been necessary to have government. This is controversial. It would have been necessary for man to rule over man. Why is that? One reason is inequality. It's just a necessity to distribute things. But it also has to do with the excellence of man. So if you know a lot of smart people in like an academic faculty, their being smart does not necessarily make them good at governing. So governance is necessary not just for fallen, sinful people, but for great people who need to be put in some order. We can think again about the angels. Each of the angels is really great, but they need to be put in an order by God. And when they reject that order, it is their perpetual unhappiness. Differences in intellectual ability require organization, but Hobbes denies that intellectual differences determine who's going to rule. Hobbes says there's not that big a difference between people intellectually. So Thomas is not just saying that it's the more intelligent who should rule. Rather, he's proposing that there is an immaterial life that we share in together, and that immaterial goods engage us. They require something that goes beyond the individual and entail a natural governance. So that governance is natural. What is the contrast of natural? Artificial, what Hobbes said. So our freedom as intellectual beings includes a natural political life. This is because the Imago Dei sets us within a divine order. It's part of the creation narrative. It's an order to which we're assimilated together in the kingdom of angels and men. What is this kingdom? Is it just a fictional kingdom of fairies? That will depend on whether we really do know immaterially, as we saw from Hobbes. And finally, the angels place a limit on our dominion. So our rule is over everything, as Genesis says. But reflection on that reveals that the angels too are ruling with us. So we have co-rulers. St. Thomas says that the angels are our partners. They're co-workers in an intelligent self-rule and a dominion over the world of the flesh. Just as we exercise power over material things, the angels can exercise power over this world, even though they're immaterial. They're not fanciful because they act. We know them by their power. The fact that we can't perceive them doesn't mean that we can't come to know their presence. And if you think about perceiving things by their effects, then we can sort of perceive them in the same way that we can perceive God in everything. So in conclusion, the idea of the image of God has spurred Christian thought to deep reflection on our rational nature. To be made ad imaginem Dei means, for Augustine, that even if our souls do not pre-exist our creation in time as persons, we can interrogate memory to arrive at a greater and greater knowledge of him to whose image we were made and to whose likeness we are gradually being transformed. Intellect in the flesh. Similarly, although with some important differences, Aquinas considers intellect in the flesh. But our specific nature, like that of the angels, but in flesh, yields ways in which we have a special share in divinity. Questions 75 through 93 of the Prima Pars, which culminate with man's end as ad imaginem Dei, show a vision of man marked by a great devotion to the animal part of rational animal. We are rational animals, which means we're animals. And it also shows a devotion to a political life lived in common in pursuit of immaterial goods and the reverence that are due to them. So against the Nietzschean denial of memory and the Hobbesian denial of sense perception, we find that being made to the image of another frees us to seek out in ourselves and in one another as well something higher than ourselves, the likeness that is our glory, the eternal and angelic vision that is our destiny. Thank you for your attention.